You're listening to the Fantasy Sports Radio Network.
Roto Experts in the Morning with your hosts, Mike Blewett and George Kurtz. Now, here's Mike and George.
Welcome back to the Fantasy Sports Radio Network. For those of you who listened to us yesterday and then gave us a leave of absence for these last 21 hours, Mike and George are back on the Roto Experts in the Morning. So appreciate you listening. We've got a lot to talk about today. The spring training stories keep on rolling. NFL free agency stories are in abundance, and people are trying to squeeze blood from a stone in many instances in what is typically kind of a lull in the sports year. I watched a little bit of the dunk contest last night. Unfortunately, it was not riveting enough to keep me awake to see the end. So, George, how are you this morning, buddy?
I'm good, Mike. I did not watch the slam dunk contest last night. I watched a lot of hockey.
You did. So what can you tell me, anything interesting that happened there, or typical goings-on in the NHL?
I would say it was a typical, you know, good night of hockey. I think there were 10, 11, 12 games. I guess the funny, it wasn't funny for me. Unfortunately, I took a nap around 5:30 and forgot to set some DFS lineups.
That's actually a good start to something to talk about. So on a typical night, you're playing DFS every night or just when you can kind of situation?
Well, with hockey, I only like to play on nights where there are a decent amount of games, probably more than five, which generally, not always, but generally takes Monday, Wednesday, and sometimes Fridays out of the equation. I think on Monday, there might have been two games. I'm not playing a two-game slate. Generally not. Not unless I'm really, I'm going to be home all night. I have nothing to do, and I want to see, I want to have something. You know, I want to watch something, want to play something. Tuesday nights are big. Thursday nights are big. And last night would have been a really nice night. I was home all night. The wife was working. The kids were out. It was a perfect night to play. I didn't plan to take that nap, Mike. I just fell asleep on the couch.
It's actually the perfect time to take a nap, though. So, you know what? I'd chalk that up as a win, even though I didn't get to play some DFS. As the father of a 19-month-old daughter with a 103 fever, I can tell you the nap, it would be much appreciated. And I'd take that over a DFS win. So, what style of games are you normally playing in the NHL? Are you going 50-50s? Are you getting into leagues? How does that play out for you?
I do a little of both, or a little, I should say. 50-50s is, how you're going to make your bankroll. Mm-hmm. You know, so that's what I'm generally going to do. I'm going to play maybe some $10 tournaments, $20 tournaments. Depends on the night. Depends how I feel. Depends how I like my lineups.
Yep.
Really, that's the big thing. The first thing I do before I decide anything is I go set a lineup, or a two or three. Do I have a couple of lineups I like? Maybe I don't have any lineups I like, and I've done that, Mike. There have been nights where I'm trying to set a lineup, and I hate life.
Yeah.
I can't find wings. I can't find a goalie. I'm not playing. I don't play just for the sake of playing. If I don't like what I'm doing, if I don't feel good about it, I'll walk away. You know, so there have been more than one night that I just decided, hey, the hell with this. It doesn't feel right. Don't feel good. I'm not playing. But generally, I'm going to play a mix of everything.
Right, and what is the setup for the lineup that you have to pick on? Is it the same on the two major sites, or are we having? Is it ranging from the type of lineup that you have to set, number of players, et cetera?
Generally, I play on DraftKings. Well, when it comes to the NHL, which is trying to make two centers. Is it three wings, two wings, 2D, goalie, and a flex? They call it utility. It's a flex. It's something along those lines. The centers are easy to find. You can generally go cheap at center. But generally, I'm crazy. I Thursday. I had a good night Thursday night. I think I cashed in every tournament I played because I went. I pretty much went all in. Went stars and scrubs. Went heavy on Crosby and McDavid. And Crosby had a goal or two assists. I think McDavid did the same. So those two alone pretty much locked me in. And I started Cam Talbot, who's a goalie that not everybody knows. He was only owned in 4% of leagues. He had a good game, so Thursday night was a good night for me. There's nothing like, if you don't quite stay up late enough to watch the end of the games, and, you know, you wake up in the morning or you wake up in the middle of the night, whatever you do, maybe you wake up at 3, 4 a.m. like I do a lot of times when I have to go to the bathroom. You look on your phone and you get that email. Oh, your account has been credited, or, you know, hey, you're a winner.
Yeah.
No better feeling than that. Have fun going back to bed after that.
Yeah, it's good stuff. Yeah, like you said yesterday, unfortunately, sometimes it's a little bit harder to go back to bed because you're excited about the win. So I would say two things, actually, based on what you said. First, I should probably take a look into at least trying out the NHL, take some pointers from you as to how to do that. I've never really played NHL DFS, so A, I'll should do that, and we should talk in the weeks ahead. Two, I think your approach about not finding lineups and bailing out is probably a good piece of advice for a lot of people. I know certainly in the NFL, people feel compelled because there's only, let's just call it 21 weeks because people do play in the playoff slates. And I'm with you. I don't normally play smaller slates. If there's a 2 or 4 game slate in the NFL by way of certain tournaments, I don't do that, like a primetime slate or anything like that. I typically don't do it. Although I will say that I did buck the trend on that during the playoffs this year, and I actually did pretty well. I entered the Millionaire Maker during some playoff weeks and cashed out. So I was happy about that. But normally I don't like to play it. But I think the greater point to what you said, listen, if you've read a bunch of articles and you've taken a bunch of leads from people on the players that you pick, but you're not feeling comfortable at all with the lineups that you're putting in, you know, it obviously it depends. It's your money, so spend it how you like. But I think it's okay to bail for a certain week. There were a couple of weeks this year in the NFL where I didn't feel like I did enough research leading up to on DFS leading up to a particular week, and I said, you know what, I'm not going to play that much, or I'm not really going to play at all. I'm like, I'll throw in $10 in this 150-50 or $20 in this 150-50 because I have not as much confidence as I normally have in a given day or in a given week.
You have to get the smart approach. Listen, football in general, the only way I wouldn't play a football Sunday is if, you know, we were just massively busy on Sunday morning. Mm. You know how Sunday mornings are for us. Yeah. We got to answer questions. We have radio shows. So much things to set up. And sometimes they've been like, I've just forgotten. There were times I forgot to set regular lineups. You know, Scott Engel, you know, makes fun of me because I tend to set my football lineups up on Tuesday, you know, when you're first eligible to. No, I don't set it and leave it. But I said it because I know how busy the weekend is going to be. And just in case Sunday was just too so busy for me that I couldn't get to it, at least I know I set an initial lineup, which means I, at the very least, took my bye players out.
Yeah, I have reminders on my phone a couple of times a week. And I'll do it on Tuesday morning, as you said, and I'll do it Thursday evening right around 7 o'clock. I think I have a reminder that goes off just to make sure I check any inactives for the Thursday night game. And I'll typically go through all the lineups then, too, and just check through all of them, make sure everything's good to go. And then, obviously, you and I are doing shows on Saturdays and Sundays for the most part. Back when I was doing the Sunday morning show during football season, it was, I mean, that's a marathon of a day, as George would attest. You're waking up at 4 a.m, kind of going through everything that you need to go through. And frankly, right up until game time kickoff, you are constantly doing things. And depending on the number of questions we have to answer, et cetera, you're right. DFS can kind of take a back seat, which is why I tried this year and failed to put in lineups the night before or the day before. So I try to work on them on Saturday night, and it just doesn't always happen, you know?
I agree. Like I said, love to play, but I'm not afraid if things don't work out for me. I'm not going to get all upset if I don't play. I'm still going to watch the games and have a good time. But yeah, like I said, Sundays during football season are – football season alone is hell for what we do. I mean, it's just incredibly busy. And like I said, baseball season, hockey, it's a little slowed down. The only other time I won't play – this is probably more for baseball than anything else, but it comes into effect in hockey too – is if I can't be around my computer to change my lineups between 6 and 7 Eastern. An hour before game time is what I'm trying to say here. Yeah. Because that's when you're going to get some lineup changes, and I don't want to take a zero. Sometimes it happens. There's nothing you can do about it. Guy doesn't play late, and you found out, 6:59. There's nothing you can do about it. That's bad luck. But, if I'm going out to dinner or something like that, then I'm walking away. Because I'm not going to say, that pitcher didn't start today. Oh, that goaltender was a late scratch in pregame skate. And if I would have been at home, I would have known that and taken him out of my lineup. So, if I'm not going to be around a computer half hour, hour before game time, not playing.
It's funny what you said about football being hell. You and I obviously are both football junkies. But what's funny about being in this industry, and it isn't a complaint, but it's an observation that you'll never see a group of people that love football more and are more relieved to watch it, to watch the season finally end, the regular season at least, than football, fantasy football writers and bloggers and broadcasters, because it is a marathon. It doesn't seem like it necessarily as a fan, but we get started basically in June, getting started writing, and that goes on until the Super Bowl, or really it goes on until the day after the regular season ends. You still have to kick in a little bit, but the research obviously goes down dramatically.
Yeah, it's all I can tell people, they ask me, you know, during football season, I'm probably working 10 to 14 hour days. You know, I answer a lot of questions. That alone takes a few hours a day. The radio show commitments, the writings that you will mention, I think I write three columns a week. It's just a lot of time, you know, but this is our slow time. Right now, I probably work 3 to 4 hours a day, and that includes the rate. That includes pretty much this radio show, yeah. The 3 hours I'm going to work here, and that's it. You know, and baseball season is a more normal routine, you know, which, yeah, your normal work day. It's football. Once we kick off in football, for me, it's probably more July, August than really June for me. My wife, kids know, hey, I'm busy most days. I'm going to start. I start my day around 9, 10, and I'm not going to finish till around midnight. You know, see, everything, and I probably still could do more if I wanted to. When it comes to football, there's always something that needs to be done.
Oh, absolutely. And what's funny, I can give you two examples of people that are friends of ours and friends of the shows, and in one case works for us. But in the last month or so, I saw Bob Harris, a football diehard, a guy that we know pretty well. We've been on our shows and vice versa. He, right around the end of the regular season, he took a picture of a stack of books that he had gotten for Christmas. He'd either asked for or whatever. And he's like, finally, I get an opportunity to read something else besides football. So he had a stack of books that he was going to dive into. And conversely, Drew Dinkmeyer of DailyRoto.com, which you go to DailyRoto.com for all your best DFS advice. He asked Twitter, because Drew effectively lives on Twitter, he asked Twitter for recommendations on documentaries. And the number of responses he got was incredible. And I'm very into documentaries. I watched Planet Earth 2 last night a little bit as well. I don't know if you're into that. I'll ask you that in a second. But he got so many responses, he spreadsheeted them. And I was like, Drew, why don't you share the spreadsheet so we can knock out some of those as well. So two examples of guys that have a little bit more free time now that football season is over.
Yeah, it's for me, I probably more catch up on TV shows. I'll binge watch and stuff like that. Yeah. I know people, everybody has to make fun of me because I don't know anything that's pop culture, nothing. Singers today, nothing. A lot of these TV shows that people watch, you never even heard of. I just don't have enough time to watch it during the other than the big shows, your Walking Deads and your Game of Thrones, stuff like that. Yeah, that I'll watch as it comes on. But other shows that people are always recommending or movies, you know, I just don't have enough time during football season. Now that it's over, same thing. I take recommendations. I always ask my brother, you know, what should I watch? Stuff like this. And he'll give me some ideas. And, you know, you can binge. And I do like binge watching.
Do you think there was a time in your life where you were up on pop culture? Or were you always sort of not the guy that was as keen to following pop culture as, I mean, now it's a different story. You got kids and, you know, demanding job and all that kind of stuff. But
well, now I just don't care. Yeah. You know, maybe in the 80s and 90s growing up, sure, I might have known pop culture. I was, I do love music, but I'm more classic rocks, 60s, 70s. 80s pop was actually, I don't mind 80s pop as well. And I probably lost interest in new music probably sometime in the 90s. And to me, it just all started to sound the same. And there were no great bands coming, or very few great bands coming out anymore. Yeah. And like I said, I guess something you have to give up something. Right, for all the stuff we do, can't pay attention to everything, can't keep up with everything. I don't know if Tony and back on the other place we used to work for, the producers would get on my case all the time because I wouldn't know anybody they were talking about. They'd bring up these names of singers or whatever, like who?
Yeah, those are young guys, and they're like very into our friends Phil and Chi. Were very. I mean, they're in their 20s. One of them just turned 30, but those guys are very up on it. They're constantly going to shows, and they knew who was who, and they had me beat as well. As you said, you got to kind of give up something once you start having kids. You're watching
cartoons and you stop watching.
Hey, what's wrong with cartoons?
Yeah, I mean,
I love cartoons.
I'm okay with cartoons. I just, you know, I've got enough of Peppa Pig and Paw Patrol to last me a lifetime. So,
can I introduce my kids like Woody Woodpecker, Tom and Jerry, Looney Tunes?
Yeah. Yeah.
My cartoons.
Yeah, that would be the way to go. I don't even know where to find those anymore. But in any event, it's going to be a loose show today, but we do have a lot of stories to go through. I'll ask George probably more hockey questions because I'm still a bit of a neophyte. Again, I like hockey, just don't watch it as much. So we'll get through it all. There's a couple of good headlines we'll come back with after this. Yankees continuing the spring training drama. I think if it wasn't spring training, it would be focused on a little bit less, but it's still a noteworthy story between Dylan Betances and the Yankee brass. But after the show today, you're going to listen to Fantasy Bagels and Baseball with Tony and Cha-Cha. Then after that's from 10 to 12. After that is Fan Rag Baseball with Al Melchior. That's 12 to 1. And then the producers with our very own Pete Considori and Chris Pavona. That's from 1 to 3. So you got a good lineup today. George and I will be here till 10 o'clock on the Fantasy Sports Radio Network. We are the Roto Experts in the Morning. Back after this. Welcome back to the Fantasy Sports Radio Network. Excuse me, Mike and George. Here until 10, and you can reach us at Fantasy Radio on Twitter. That's at FNTSY Radio. I'm at Mike Blewett. George is at George Kurtz. And feel free to give us a call about anything you want today. Let's try to keep it fantasy related, but it's 844-843-6879. That's 84-FNTSY. So, George, a lot of different stories coming around this time of year, as you and I have detailed. Sometimes it's probably a little over-dramatized because of the lack of goings-on in the baseball world. But I did find it a little odd that Randy Levine, the president of the Yankees, sort of in an interview kind of went at Dylan Betances's, it's probably more his management than him personally, but he was really exulting over his victory in arbitration. Dylan Betances was aiming for $5 million in arbitration. He ended up settling on $3 million, which is a fairly well-established number in MLB, but I think his management's thought process was that he's done more. He's closed in the past. He's been invaluable to the Yankees. So what were your thoughts about some of his comments? I'll read them after you comment.
Oh, God. How about shut the hell up?
Yeah.
I mean, I think that. Why would you say anything? All right, you won. I understand you. Maybe you wanted to make a point that because there was a big gap. Betances, his camp wanted $5 million. The Yankees over $3 million. I guess the Yankees knew they would win according to how these precedents go. And Betances' agent may have been trying to set a new precedent. And that's all fine and good. You won. Shut up. There's no reason to gloat, spike the ball, do a dance, you know, go on TV and announce it, have a press conference. Are you kidding me? If I'm Hal Steinbrenner, if I own the team, I am ticked off that you know, Levine did this. Why would you want to piss a player off? There was no reason to do this.
It was childish.
Yes, it was. You know, hey, like I said, it was taking the ball, spiking the ball over nothing. You won. Great. Why would you want to, especially a good soldier like Betances, who's done everything you've asked. Betances could gripe. He's a very good pitcher who's stuck in them once again in the setup role because the Yankees keep signing, I mean, better pitchers. I get it. But it hurts his role. And if I'm Betances right now, I don't blame him at all if he's just counting down the days till he's gone.
Yeah, and George, based on what we were talking about yesterday in terms of the closer role, and it tied into Goose Gossage's comments, but frankly, we had a little bit of a consensus between yourself, myself and Matt Modica about the setup role being actually more difficult than the closer's role. And he's done both. He's asked in some instances to do more than somebody like Chapman has been and Miller has been. I'm not suggesting that he's a better pitcher. I'm just saying he's been asked to do more. Honestly, we saw a couple of years ago how his overuse, perhaps, hurt him a little bit at the end of the year.
Oh, absolutely. We've seen Girardi. It is definitely. I mean, I think it's been more than 1 year. Joe Girardi is used, but Tons at times has been just god-awful. Bring him in with a 6-run lead, a 4-run lead, and then you do this in May, you pay for it in September. Yeah, just been. I mean, if you can't trust your other members of your bullpen to protect a 4-run lead or a 6-run lead, or if you panic because the first batter gets on in a 5-run lead in the ninth inning, you have a problem. Those guys shouldn't be on the team then. You know, it's been baffling how Girardi has used Betances at times. That being said, I understand he's had his issues. You know, when he has had to close, sometimes he has been able to come through, has had the yips last year throwing the ball. That's all fine and good. You know, the arbitration process is really a joke anyway. It's built up to tear people down. I mean, what kind of process is that? But that being said, there's just no reason to do what Levine did. I mean, no reason to do it. He's done this before where he's put his foot in his mouth. He feels like he has to talk for some reason. Protect the team.
I totally agree.
Sometimes you don't need to do that. Just you won. Be happy you won. Move on.
He's held some of the strangest press conferences that we've seen as Yankees fans. Like, what? Why is he here? It's sort of like a, why is he here and why is he talking about this? Can we just leave this to Brian Cashman or Hal? He's very much an image guy. I think he wants to let people know, remind people that he is the president of the New York Yankees. I'd say he's amongst all of the 30 MLB teams, there's probably not too many more outspoken presidents than him. There's a few that are more famous than him, but I always feel like it's a reminder to let people know that he still has that job. So here's what one of his quotes was. What his agents did, and I think Jim Murray is the agent for Dellin Betances. Let me just make sure I have that name right. Jim Murray. So what his agents did was make him a victim of an attempt to change a marketplace in baseball that has been well established for 30, 40 years. And I feel bad for him that it was used that way by his agents. So he's claiming that Betances was used. Levine said this after the ruling was announced. $5 million goes to elite closers, people who pitch the ninth inning and have a lot of saves. Dellin didn't have that record. He's a great elite setup man. Maybe one day he'll be a great closer. We hope so. The agent took him to a case in like me saying, I'm not the president of the Yankees, I'm an astronaut. I'm not an astronaut, and Dellin Betances is not a closer based on statistics. So, laying it out right there. On the flip side, Dellin says, I was planning to put this all behind me. But for him to say I'm a victim and my agent's using me, I felt like I was asking for a fair deal. Taking the ball, most setup men pitch for one inning and went out there for three innings or multiple or guys on base all the time. That's my job, but I continue to do it over and over, just trying to help the team. And for me to even go through this process, that's what upsets me the most. So there you go, George. That's it in a couple of quotes. There's more that was said, but those are the really two major ones that come out of this.
Yeah, I mean, Levine, this is lawyer speak. He doesn't have the statistics. Yes, because he's not used in that role. But you and I already discussed, he's probably more valuable than a lot of closers. $5 million for an elite closer? Are you kidding? $5 million is throwaway money. Elite closers are making almost three times that amount of money now. How much did you just pay Chapman?
I was just about to say that.
So, it made no sense what he said. The only thing I said, he didn't have the stats. Yes, he doesn't have the stats because the Yankees don't use him in that role. But that's not to say he's not valuable. He's more valuable. I wouldn't say with Chapman, no. But close. They do use him in multiple innings. Inning in the third, inning in two-thirds to get them out of jams. He could be that setup man we're on. Quite a few nights he will be more valuable than Chapman because he's going to be asked to get the tough outs. Chapman's just going to get the ninth inning outs. It's a little bit different story there. I think Levine just... I understand. I do get what he was trying to say in a point about how Chapman's agent probably was trying to set precedent here for a top setup man to get paid.
Yeah.
I get that, and I guess you want to channel a little Negan. Levine was trying to shut that SH down. I get it. Okay, I get what he was trying to do, but why would you disparage your own player in the process? Why are you talking about another player's agent? Why are you talking about another player? A player who hasn't said a word. This is not the A-Rod situation where A-Rod attacked him back in the steroid issues. That's the only time I ever felt bad for Levine, when A-Rod actually attacked him. That's one thing. This was not that. Not even close. There was no reason for him to say anything.
Yeah. So Jim Murray responded to Fox Sports' Ken Rosenthal, calling Levine's statements reprehensible and outright false, while claiming that Levine mispronounced Betances' first name repeatedly during the hearing, while blaming Betances for the Yankees' drop in attendance and their lack of recent playoff victories while attempting to, quote, bully the panel. The only person, this is a quote, the only person overreaching in this entire situation is Randy. He might as well be an astronaut because nobody on Earth would agree with what he's saying. It's actually a good line. It's a good line.
That is a pretty good line.
Yeah. They take me in the room and they trash me for about an hour and a half. This is Deline. It's Deline, right? I want to make sure I'm not mispronouncing. I know a lot of people say Delin. I think it's Deline, technically, right?
No, I've always heard it being called Delin.
All right. So I'm going to go with Delin then, because that's what I've been saying. They take me in a room and they trash me for about an hour and a half, he said. I thought that wasn't fair. I felt like I've done a lot for this organization, especially over the last 3 years. Whenever they needed me, I was there for them. I never said no. So just more of the same. I mean, he's a New York City kid, too.
He's wrong about that. I mean, that's why arbitration is stupid, because they tear you down. If you didn't know that was coming, then your agent should be fired, because he should have warned you about that.
Yeah,
that's coming. Like I said, arbitration, like any contract, you can't take it personal, and so you have to just let it go off. The team's going to fight for what they believe in. You're going to fight for what you believe in. So they're going to tear you down. I don't like it. I don't like it because of that. I mean, this is why so many teams don't want to go to arbitration.
Yeah,
you know, they want to cut that middle somewhere, but they can't. You know, it was a $2 million difference.
They're forced to be in an adversarial situation with their own player.
It's an idiotic process, but like I said, Betances didn't know that was coming. Well, that's on his agent. That is on Jim Murray, if he didn't know that. And I'm sure Murray told him. How could Betances not know himself? Other players would have told him what's coming. So I think he's wrong in that sense, yes. We all know that it's going to be an uncomfortable situation.
Yeah. I remember seeing an interview once with Scott Boras, and he was talking about as part of the interview, he was talking about an upcoming arbitration case, and he showed the reporter, the camera, the files that he was about to use to go into that arbitration case, and it was multiple encyclopedias, if you can remember what those are to some of my younger listeners, multiple encyclopedias worth of statistics for this one arbitration case that he was going to use to prove the case to try to get his client more money. So obviously, it's a heavily litigated kind of situation, and as he said, it puts him in a tough spot.
It does, and that's just the nature of how it's gone. You really can't take it personally. So, you hope Betances puts it behind him. He really should, because it's for his benefit that he does. Go out there, pitch well. If you don't like the way you're treated, you move on a couple years when you're a free agent. You don't have to sign with the Yankees. There's no franchise tag here. There's no transition tag. You'll get paid by somebody. You'll be a closer for somebody. I don't think there's any doubt about that. And by the way, one interesting note that was brought up by, I think it was Andrew Marchand of ESPN. If the Yankees don't play well this year, they're bottoming out again, which is a pretty good chance it'll happen with that rotation. Guess who's their most marketable player to trade at the deadline?
Yeah, Betances. He's somebody that could close and certainly somebody that could bolster a bullpen that's lacking.
Exactly. So he'd be the player who could bring back the biggest, by far, the biggest return, just like it did with Andrew Miller and Chapman last year. Betances could be that player this year. Only difference is he is on the team control.
I was just about to add. He's a New York City product too. He grew up a Yankees fan, and he's from Brooklyn originally. So he's not a free agent until 2020. He acknowledged Saturday's experience could affect his loyalty to the organization. You look at it differently now, Betances said. I think it'll be a little easier when the time comes. CC Sabathia had some comments for him. He tried to convince him that he's still making a lot of money. It's one thing he keeps telling him. He'll be able to bounce back, separate the business from the game, and be able to come out and do his job.
Exactly.
So I think it puts him in a funk, frankly, and I think it's a shock to the system, I'm sure. You know, he's still a young guy, but I think he's realizing now what the story is. It's the Yankees' first trip to arbitration since 2008 when they defeated right-hander Chien-Ming Wong, who was awarded a raise from $489,500 to the team's $4 million offer instead of his $4.6 million request. So it is actually, and the last time they went to arbitration, this is ironic, was 2000 when they defeated, guess who, of all players in 2000?
2000? I don't know. Jeter.
Mariano Rivera. So putting themselves up against.
Don't compare him to Goose.
Yeah, exactly. to give you an idea, George, the irony of those contracts, that throwing out those contractual numbers earlier, is that they just signed the largest contract ever for a closer, Aroldis Chapman, back in December, which was 5 years and $86 million, which had shattered the industry record for relievers set just 2 days earlier by new Giants closer Mark Melancon, whose four-year $62 million deal had itself topped Jonathan Papelbon's four-year $50 million contract back in 2011. So there we go. Those are the numbers. The numbers even 4, 5, 6 years ago for closers were over $12 million annually, not the $5 million that Randy Levine mentioned.
Yeah, it's good to be a reliever. Good to throw one inning.
Yeah, it's not bad. It's good work if you can get it. So, all right, so that's a little story from the Yankees. The Bronx Zoo continues to run rampant this spring training, and we'll get to more stories after the break. Mike and George on the Roto Experts in the Morning. Welcome back to the Fantasy Sports Radio Network. So we're talking a little bit about the Yankees drama. Somebody that was involved in some drama early over the last couple of years. Not too much off-the-field nonsense, but a little bit of it. And now he's fully cashed in on a four-year, $110 million deal with the Mets that he signed in November. It was really the one thing the Mets had to do, right, George? Was sign Yoenis Cespedes back to Queens to make sure he was a part of their long-term future, correct?
Yeah, they need somebody who can hit, which is in that lineup. They don't have a whole lot of it.
Yeah, so he did sign it back in November, 4 years, $110 million. The story really is about him being focused on bringing the team a championship. So we all know, listen, I was not on his side with this. Yoenis was having that hamstring injury, right? He had that hamstring issue, and he was on the DL, but still going out golfing because he loves golf, right? And there was thoughts that he shouldn't be doing that. There was it was fodder for sports radio in the New York area, and that was really the only kind of drama other than the contractual stuff that's gone on with him for the last couple of years, right? He's been mostly okay off the field.
Yeah, I don't know what it is with fans and golf. I mean, you go back to maybe football, they got all over Tony Romo for trying out for and he was healthy. I mean, do the fans actually believe that professional athletes can do nothing but their sport? Can only do bad? You know, I understand suspension is a little different because he had an injury, and I would probably agree that he should have been playing. Yeah. But, you know, they're allowed to have a social life. You know, they're allowed to go out. They're allowed to do whatever they want to do. I had no problem with Romo playing golf. Wouldn't have a problem with Cespedes playing golf other than the injury. You know, people think, oh, it's golf. He's not going to re-injure it. You know, it's a lot of walking you got to do. It's a lot of, you know, you're turning your body. You aren't doing some violent moves. So no,
It isn't worth it to me.
And you got to know you're going to hear about it.
That's right.
You know, they're going to find out. They're going to get all over for you for it. The reward is just not worth the risk.
Yeah. And listen, like it's relating it to what happened in another sport. It was very high profile again, New York area. This is not meant to be a New York based show, but it's just sort of how things are rolling this morning. In any event, I had no issue with Odell Beckham and the receivers and whomever else went down there for the Miami situation on their off day before the playoff game. Would I have taken an Instagram picture? Obviously
not. There's the problem. Why publicize it? Once again, right. You have to know that they're going to kill you. I said, I had no problem with it either, but as soon as you saw it, I'm like, oh, God, here we go. And you're in New York. You know they're going to eat this up. You know, everyone's looking for a story. So they're going to make a story out of a non-story. Romo, again, when he went to Cabo San Lucas, is that what it's called? With whatever his girlfriend was at the
time. Jason Witten and Witten and his wife or something like that.
Yeah. And what's wrong with that? What is wrong with that? Nothing wrong with that. If he went on the beach a couple of 100 miles away, that'd be okay. But because he went out of country on a bye week, that's bad. I mean, it makes no sense. But why would you take that picture and get it all over social media? You have to know. And if you don't know, you're really an idiot. Yeah. You have to know that it's going to be overblown. And if you happen to lose that game and you play badly, which Beckham did on both counts, you're never going to hear the end of it.
Yeah, and Odell's still pretty young, and I remember back when this happened, George, we had you know, I read some quotes from Tom Brady, who was kind of backing him up and said, you know what, back in the day, I probably would have done something like that too, but I learned over time it just kind of isn't worth it. I got a few more weeks left in the season if I'm lucky enough to win those games, and we can just do it then. We don't need to rush down to Miami to party on our one off day. You know, you can just kind of tough it out for a few more weeks. I don't ultimately have an issue with what he did. I would just suggest, as somebody who, frankly, is a little bit older than him, maybe a little bit wiser, has seen these situations before, it's not really going to work out well for you if you happen to lose. And it's not worth it even if you win, because do you really want to take heat all week and then get into some argument with a reporter and be like, ah, I told you it was no big deal after the game? Do you know what I mean? It just creates momentum against you.
I think players have to learn, you know, there are so many media outlets, you know, and we're one of them.
Yeah.
We're all looking for a story. Yeah, you're looking for a story. You're looking at and listen, they're going to overblow things. I said this had nothing to do with this. Or Beckham and the receivers going down to Miami, wherever it was, had nothing to do with them losing. Nothing to do with Beckham not dropping a couple of balls. Nothing. But I think what Brady said is right. If you have a bad game, it's, you know, then once again, the reward is not worth the risk. It's just not worth all the aggravation you're going to take, all the questions you have to answer. And if I'm his teammates, I'm not thrilled either, not because I think it hurt the game, but because now I have to answer questions about it. You know, if I'm on that team, I have to answer why Odell Beckham didn't play well, whether I thought it was the you know, being on the boat, being in Miami, being in the sun, rather than being up in New York. You know, it was their off day. Once again, I don't know about you, Mike. I do things on my off day. Don't you do things on your off day?
Of course.
Oh, boy, it's going to hurt the show because I went out to dinner with my wife last night when I went to the beach. You know, it's really just silly.
Yeah, I took my son to a basketball game last night. I put that on social media. I'm not going to catch heat for it because I'm not famous. It doesn't matter. Like, obviously, we're trying to do our job to the best of our ability. I would say, you know, going back to Odell for a second, I do think he's a distraction and his on-field and off-field antics in general. As an isolated moment, I don't think that was a big deal going to Miami. I don't think he should have done it based on what is the optimal thing for him to do, the optimal action there. Is it hugely negative? I don't think so. But I think it would be optimal if he didn't do all of that, if that makes sense.
Oh, yeah. No, listen, he is a distraction with everything else he does. And that just made this thing bigger.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
If he wasn't that player, you know, if he was Julio Jones, who really has never done anything off the field, just more on the field, you know, it may not be quite as big a thing. It wouldn't be quite as big a thing if he's playing Atlanta and not New York.
Yeah.
You know, once again, the two biggest things, New York and Dallas, you know, two epicenters of football. So, yeah, you just have to realize that. I mean, if you don't know, talk to your agent. He'll tell you. Yeah, you still want to go through it? You still want to take the heat? That's fine. You know, but really, I mean, just think before you act. And like I said, on the overall scheme of things, everything else that's going on in the NFL, you know, players being arrested for assault, all the DWs, this is really very minor to really nothing. It's just an overblown, but you have to realize it's football. America loves football, and everyone's looking for a story. And, you know, you look at ESPN, they still have NFL Live and NFL Insight is on for an hour, 2 hours a day during the offseason.
Yeah.
Everyone is still looking for it's football. It's massive. Everyone's looking for a story, even during the off season, more or less during playoff time.
So we're in the content business. The best thing that happened on our show yesterday was the fact that Goose Gossage shot his mouth off again, and we had a lot of content to go off of. You know, these are we're guilty of it. We're in the content business, as is ESPN and all the other outlets that we have out there, searching for stories. Like you said, the Instagram picture of the boat is a gold mine for shows like, not necessarily like ours. We didn't spend too much time on it, but it's hell. It happened a month ago, and we're talking about it right now. So that's just the nature of it. And, you know, do I think they listen to their agents regarding personal decisions? No, I think that's part of it. I just don't.
Have you listened to the Tony Cicada and the Mike DeMergis blow up again?
I've listened to it like five times.
So have I, you know. And it's funny. I played it for my wife last night. I thought it was hilarious. I have a couple of things about it. One, you know, you listen to Cardano. Maybe a conspiracy theory, but it seemed like he was trying to set DeMergis up in the beginning to let Tony go at him. But then it also seemed like, as it going on, that Tony was trying to give Mike a chance by you know, sort of hinting at where he could go with this to help him out, and Mike didn't take advantage of it. Now, it may have been none of this. Mike just may have been, hey, you know, let's see what happens here. But that's what I got read from it.
And you're saying Cardano was trying to feed Tony?
I thought in the beginning he was. Hey, listen, it's radio. You know, you want to get guys going sometimes. And I think with Tony, and I haven't asked him. I really would like to know. I wonder if he really cared about this, or if he was just looking to say, hey, I think he put it on Facebook. Listen, you want to have me on a Friday night after a long week? Who knows what's going to happen? something to that effect. And I know that with Tony, where he just maybe said, I don't even care about the Scoot Scotches thing, but I'm going to start trouble tonight.
But Tony did preface the whole thing. And to those who haven't listened to it, I will tweet it out during the show. The audio of what happened on the Goose Gossage argument. We talked about it at length yesterday. Goose Gossage had a lot of pointed comments towards current day closers and other people as well, particularly Aroldis Chapman, a current Yankee, Mo Rivera, considered to be the greatest closer of all time. He doesn't relate to them. He doesn't want to be compared to them. He finds it insulting that he's compared to modern-day relievers. Anyway, an argument ensued between Tony Cincotta, Mike Demergis of our very Fantasy Sports Network. Got a little heated. I think everybody's friends by the time the show ends, but it was literally at the end of the show. There was a little bit of name-calling. There was a little bit of swearing, so I will make sure that you see that. I'll tweet it out again. I think I tweeted it out yesterday. In any event, I do think there was a little bit of gamesmanship there by Tony, but at the same time, I don't think he expected the blow-up that happened. Last thing I would say on it is he did preface by saying, I've looked at this research before, and I find him to be wildly overrated.
I don't think I said this yesterday. You can't compare yesteryear's players in any sport. It's just different. I said the ammunition for Mike. I didn't even know that Goose Guys had blown 112 saves. I decided some of them are probably because he did pitch multiple innings, but he didn't always pitch multiple innings, folks. He did it more often than not. You look at his innings pitch, you can see that. But he didn't always pitch 2-3 innings. I found that to be a little silly, but I didn't know that. You know, so I found that interesting. Wow, 112. You know, Tony brought up that means a quarter of the games he was in, he technically blew. So I found that funny. Not funny, but I found that interesting to say the least. I think the main ammunition for Mike would have been, I think Cardona. And this is why I think Cardona was trying to help Demergis. Cardona kept saying, well, you only saved 33 saves. You know, yes, 33 saves today is not a lot. Back then, it was. It would have put you top three. In most seasons, top three, top five.
Yeah, he led the league in three times with saves, like 27 saves, 30 saves.
And Demergis didn't go after that. He could have really. I think he was so mad. See, this is why getting into an argument with Tony is tough. Tony's still in control. Yelling, but he's still in control. Mike, I don't think was. I think Demergis. I think he was a little angry. He was so angry he wasn't thinking of it, because I think Cardona was trying to help him there. I mean, he may not have been, but I thought he was sort of setting him up there. I'm like, okay, because even yesterday listening to him, I'm like, okay, come on. Go for it, Mike. Say it. You know, he wouldn't go after it. He wouldn't, because I think Cardona was giving us some ammunition to go back at Tony. Like I said, I may be reading this all wrong, but when I look at it over and over again, maybe it was more subconsciously. But either way, it was great radio. It was funny. And the best thing about this, you barely hear Corey say a word. It's one of those things where I can see Corey like trying to be a fly on the wall and just enjoying it.
Corey basically was like, I don't know too much about Goose Gossage, but this 112 blown saves has me rethinking it.
That's it. We can all cherry pick a stat and go at it. The 112 saves, I admit, took me off guard. Didn't expect that.
It's the most in MLB history, by the way. He's the most blown.
A lot of it is because I think the merger said it. He did. Gotsis did hang on forever.
Part of it. But George, here's the most blown saves in MLB history. Gossage is first. Raleigh Fingers is second. Jeff Reardon, Lee Smith, John Franco, Bruce Sutter.
It's all the greats.
Yeah, these are all great pitchers, and, you know, it was a different time. Let's take a quick break here. We'll continue with this and get back to Yoenis Céspedes after this. Welcome back. Welcome back. George and I here till 10 o'clock, heading towards the end of the first hour. We're talking a little bit about the Goose Gossage situation over the weekend and arguing back and forth. On the blown saves thing, he does have the most blown saves of all time. He threw 1,800 innings. That should be noted. It's a ton of innings. Granted, he did start at points during his career. We found out yesterday he was an All-Star with a 9-17 record. So I'd have to go back through the game logs in order to see how good that first half was compared to the second half, George.
I think you hit it. Yes, it had to be because of the good first half. I don't remember how they did the voting back then. Fans weren't a part of it back then. We have to remember that. I'm almost positive of that. So he must have had a rocket first half. But that was surprising with a 9-17 record. Back then, you know, we didn't have all the sabermetrics back then. Your record was really what determined if you were going to make the All-Star game or not.
Yeah, I'm trying. The only modern guy in here, Roberto Hernandez, is the only guy I can really see in the top 10 here that's even like remotely a modern pitcher. And I don't even know. I don't remember when his career ended. He has like 94 career blown saves. So everybody else is, you know, kind of an older player. Mike Timlin is relatively modern there with 80 blown saves. But really, those top guys, like we talked about, those are the greats. Those guys are in, those guys are Hall of Famers. So I can't just, while Mike Demers might have been cherry picking certain years and certain stats in certain years.
Mike was bringing up 77 to 85. That wasn't cherry picking. That's a 9-year career there. That's not cherry picking.
We showed it yesterday. The 75 to 85, Goose was on fire.
Right. That's not cherry picking. That's fine. You know, and I think he was more 77 to 85, which is 9 years. That's not cherry picking. That's fine. You take a year. I think he kept saying 1980 at a 2.01 ERA or 2.05. That's cherry picking. You know, 1 year doesn't matter. If 1 year mattered, there'd be everybody be in the Hall of Fame eventually. Everybody has a career year.
I think to your point, you can take out a swath of stats like that and say, listen, Goose was dominant for a 10-year period. That's what gets him in the Hall of Fame. He was one of the best in the business, if not the best of all time, up to that point. If I'm siding with Tony, I could say, well, that's only half the guy's career. He pitched in 22 seasons. What happened the other 10 to 12 years of his career? And a lot of it we discussed yesterday. He was hanging on. He was out of the league. He was back in the league. And he was really playing. He was pitching in a different role towards the end of his career.
Yeah, I said, I think Goose is a whole. First of all, I don't care about the Hall of Fame. I think I've said this many times. You know, to me, it's kind of a joke. There are a lot of players in who shouldn't be in. I don't think Goose is in that category. I think he's as a Hall of Fame, I have no issues with him. I think he deserves it. I think he was a dominant reliever of his time. Him, Suter, and Raleigh Fingers would be the top three there. I know what all he was Goose sought after. Sure. I mean, any team would have loved to have had him back then, maybe outside of St. Louis and Oakland, who had the other two guys. So I don't have any issue with him being in the Hall of Fame. But like I said, I don't care about this. I truly don't. I do believe in some of Goose's comments. Back then, relievers were different. You know, the reason why he wasn't going to have 50 save seasons was because he would pitch multiple innings. And if you pitch multiple innings, you're probably not going the next day. You're not going 3-4 days in a row. You know, it was just a different way of going about things back then. You know, I think Goose said in his interview, they didn't even term the term closer back then. And that's also true. You know, closer really didn't come out until the 80s, not the 70s. So it was different. It was just different. So I understand what Goose is going at. I don't understand why he feels the need to keep bringing it up. Does he really think being compared to Mariano Rivera is a bad thing? You know, that's silly. I would love to be compared to him. I don't care if my role wasn't the same. I don't care if the role was the exact opposite. You're being compared to Mariano Rivera, who most consider the best reliever ever. What's compared there?
Yeah, I don't have an issue with it. You shouldn't have an issue with it. And I think Goose is just, you know, he's a fired up guy. He's probably same on the field as he was off the field. Very fiery. It seems cantankerous these days. I don't side with him on his commentary, but
if he wants to keep being invited to Yankee camp, you might want to really tone this down a bit.
Well, it's a little difficult to try to tell the players not to shoot their mouth off when the team president can't keep himself from insulting the player that he just won an arbitration deal with.
Yeah, you know, you got a point. And once again, it's the Bronx Zoo of the 70s. I think you said it earlier. You know, what the Yankees used to be like in the 70s. If any, you know, the funniest book I ever read, anybody wants to go back and read about the 70s Yankees, was Balls by Greg Nettles. That's what got him traded. Because Steinman read that book, saw the advanced copy of the book, saw that it was going to be disparaged. The Yankees traded him to San Diego. So, you know, it's what happened. Craig Nettles had, when you're speaking of Goose, you know, Goose was acquired in, 78 after Sparky Lyle won the Cy Young in 77. Nettles had the greatest line ever, that Sparky Lyle went from Cy Young to sayonara.
Yeah, exactly. And we didn't even get into the fight that Goose Gossage got into with Cliff Johnson back in 79. And Gossage suffered a severe thumb injury. So I mean, it was a big story back then. If something like that happened now, God help me. I don't know. I don't think anybody would ever stop talking about it. It did. I don't know if anybody would ever stop talking about it. But
it was also the season where Thurman Munson passed away. So that was a 79 was a bad season.
Yeah. But yeah, that was a just sort of a one-time thing. Those guys were friends. We'll get to Yoenis Cespedes and the story I wanted to talk about after
maybe.
The break. But yeah, maybe eventually. But it's kind of interesting because those guys are friends. It's Cliff Jones Gossage, but they got into a fight. He suffered this severe injury, and I think you know, both players could probably be blamed for it in retrospect. It's just kind of one of those things.
Yes.
Yeah, just one of those strange things that, you know, creates that myth of the Bronx Zoo, and it's probably less of a myth and more of a truth. I think baseball players were much different back then, you know, kind of it was, I don't want to say less professional, but it was still kind of a loose profession, right? There wasn't as much money on the line. Guys were making a nice living, but it wasn't really covered to the extent that it's covered now. We didn't have 24-hour networks and the like, so it was all about the beat writers, right? That's why baseball beat writers had one of the toughest jobs in the world, and it's why they were so well-respected, because they provided all of the information about the teams.
Well, baseball's always been romanticized. I mean, you mentioned the beat writers. If you want to watch a good series, when it was a game, really, about
that goes it's great.
About 40s, 50s, and 60s and stuff like that. But that's fantastic about what's going on there. You know, you said it. They really didn't start getting paid till the late 70s. Reggie Jackson, when he came over. That's when the salaries started to really drive up. Back then, a lot of players in the 40s, 50s, 60s had second jobs, and they needed playoff money. You know, that money was big, which is why the Yankees Red Sox always has those heated rivalries. You go to the playoffs, that's extra money, and these players wanted that extra money.
No doubt. This is 1 hour down, folks. We got 2 hours to go. We'll talk a little about Yoenis Cespedes. We're going to talk catchers. We're going to continue to talk about the MLB, NFL free agency. At the top of the hour, it's again 1 hour down, 2 hours to go on the Roto Experts in the Morning.